My mama told me sometimes it's just a long day in school. All right, we're going to have three speakers today. And the opening act is a newfound friend of mine from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Ken S. Please welcome him.
Good morning. My name's Ken. I'm an alcoholic. And what an honor it is to be here. If my group back home could see me now, you know. South Dakota has 9 Native American reservations. And I was born on one called Rosebud. I grew up there, and I lived there most of my life. When I started my education, I started in the Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding schools. And those systems, you have maybe 300 or more boys in a dormitory with a limited number of staff, and you're pretty much get your needs met that way. So it's not like growing up in a home, you know, with parents and your family. And that's the way I grew up. And as a result of that, my life was filled with a lot of things that later in life I needed to address. And I think prior to that, I guess I want to say one thing before I get too far into my story. I want to share my story in a general way, you know, what my life was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And to do that, I have to reach into myself and grab those parts of me that are painful. And forgive me if I do get emotional up here. I'm going to try to tell my story as best I can. When I was born, my mother was alcoholic, a severe alcoholic. She's 7/8 Lakota Sioux. And my father, I don't know. I don't know who my father is to this day. When I was born in Rosebud, my mother left me at the hospital there. Because of her alcoholism, I suppose. But about a week later, my grandmother went down to the hospital and she took me home and she became my mother. We buried my grandmother 5 years ago. She was 91 years old. She used to always say, I want to live long enough to see you graduate from high school. You know, I had the privilege of calling her my mother for over 50 years. What an honor that was. And she was a very spiritual woman. Taught me how to pray. Taught me how to gain some sense of spiritual knowledge as well as survive. I started those boarding schools and boy, my life was, when I was a little bitty guy, we used to pick up those cigarette butts laying around and used to fire them up and, you know, little guys, you know, who started smoking cigarettes. And somewhere around the age of 9, when I started my step one in this program, I had to look, you know, at some of those origins. And maybe at the age of 8 or 9 years old, we were already huffing lighter fluid. Huffing gas, huffing spray paint and glue, you know, things like that. I never got to the alcohol yet, but even at that age, that's what I was doing. And I grew up in those boarding schools that way. Emotionally, you have to be I saw that movie about Faisal. What is that called? American something. And he gets, the little mouse gets lost, and he gets with these other street mice or something, and he starts sniffing around, you know, and they look at him and say, hey, you got to get tough. You want to survive out here, you know. And that's kind of how it was in those boarding schools, you know. You couldn't be, you had to be a certain way. You had to take care of yourself. If you were too weak, you got victimized, you know. And there were all kinds of things going on in that boarding school. People from abusive families, sexual abusive families, you know, all kinds of things, you know. And it was quite an education there. I stayed in those boarding schools till I was a 10th grader. And then I missed the bus back to the boarding school, the Flandreau Indian School. I missed the bus back. And the reason I missed the bus because I was in jail in White River, where our home group is now. And I was accused of breaking into the Wood Liquor Store, of all things. Oh, my. But I was in there, and the bus came, and the bus went back, and I missed it. And so I started public school there in Wood, a small high school. I think when I graduated high school, there was 10 of us in our class. And it was the first time in my life that I sat next to, you know, the cowboys and the farmers and, you know, there was, I think, three of us Native Americans in that school. And it was a cultural shock, you know. Prior to that, I went to all Indian schools, you know. And for the first time in my life, I was in a public school. And there was a lot of adjustments. And in my family was an alcoholic family. There was a lot of drinking, you know. Sometimes on the streets, my parents, my grandparents would be drinking on the streets in uptown. And the rest of my family would be obviously drunk. And the whole community knew, you know. And I grew up that way. Kind of shameful about that, you know, and myself, I was drinking regularly by the time I hit high school. I was drinking every weekend, you know, and I fell in with this crowd of farmers. They used to go to town every Wednesday. I'd jump in with them. I was, I had another gift. I was an athlete. I was a very good athlete, and so that opened a lot of doors for me. You know, people who normally would not talk to me would talk to me because of that fact. And I started running with these guys, and we started drinking on Wednesday nights too. And it just went that way, you know. By the time I was, and I don't know how I graduated, I missed a whole lot of school because of drinking. We'd start drinking Friday night, and we'd take off, and we'd be all over the reservation, you know, different drinking spots and getting into fights and, you know, raising Cain. And man, I'd seen a lot of things, you know, in that kind of environment. I lived in Sioux Falls for a while, and I used to tell my white friends, I said, you guys are lucky, you know, you can call the cops and they'll be here, maybe 5 minutes or less, you know. And back home, you're lucky if they show up, you know. So it's kind of like you're on your own out there, you know, in the rural areas. It takes a long time for the cops to get there. And I managed to get through high school, and all of my friends were signing up for college and doing all these things, and so that's what I did. I can't even remember my first drunk. I think by the time I was 12 years old or so, my brother was helping one of the elders in the community. He knew how to make beer, he knew how to make wine. And my brother was helping him pick the cherry, make some choke cherry wine, a whole bunch of gallons in his basement. And my brother had the key. So one night, some of us went over there, opened up the cellar, and I don't know, maybe got about 5 gallons of that wine. And this old junk car by our place, the windows were all good and everything, so we sat in that car, and man, we started drinking that wine and talking, and oh man, we had a party in that little car, and we weren't driving all over the world, you know, in that car. We got drunk, and the sun started to come up, and my grandparents got up, and man, we were only, you know, we were very young, but we were just very, very drunk. And I think that's probably the first real alcohol drunk that I can remember. And I liked it. You know, I liked it because with all of the things that I'd experienced in my life, I was a very closed, I didn't know how to, the boarding schools didn't prepare me. I had some psychological things. By the time I was growing up, I've come to realize that my brothers and sisters were really my aunts and uncles, and my grandmother and grandfather was really who they are. I thought they were my mom and dad, you know. And so the realities of life start to come in, and the fact that I didn't know who my father was, you know, that was a shameful, painful thing. And so I started to kind of invert, you know, going to myself. And it was very quiet most of my life, very shy. You know, I remember going to that public school and reading from our English literature books. And the teacher would go around and each person would read, you know, each person would read a section. And when it came to me, I was so paralyzed. I couldn't read. I would get hot. I'd start to sweat. And I just couldn't talk. I just couldn't talk, you know. And pretty soon they'd pass me up and they'd go to the next person. And those were really extremely uncomfortable situations. But that's the way I was at that time. And when I started drinking that alcohol, boy, some of those feelings, the inhibitions went away, you know. And I started to feel freer. I started to feel, you know, kind of like the way I wanted to feel. And at the time, I didn't realize it, but that's what alcohol, I was depending on that to do those things for me. I could laugh, I could sing, I could dance, I could, you know, say the things that I didn't know how to say, you know. But without that alcohol, I was back in that paralyzed state, you know. And it stayed like that. Because everybody was signing up for college, I went to college too. I went to a teacher's college. The athletic department was interested in me, and so it was easier for me to get in. And I drank, because I was an athlete on campus, I had to sneak around and drink, you know. And a few times I got caught, open container downtown or something, and that would be taken care of too, you know. And so I was very fortunate. I had a good college career. I graduated from college in 1972. And after I graduated, I got immediately drafted. Missed going to Vietnam by a few days. When I was getting inducted and sworn in, the recruiter came in and said, as of today, no more draftees will be sent to Vietnam. You know, so I just barely missed it. I ended up in Germany. And the drinking continued. Only in Germany, oh, they had a lot of drugs there. I don't know if some of you have been over there, but, oh, man. And so, why not, you know? I got into all kinds of drugs. I got into some LSD, and I got into those downers, and, oh, man, you know, I could barely function with those things. Then I start getting into uppers and speed, and, boy, I was afraid to take those because I'd tell them where I'd end up, you know. I'd start a quiet evening, and by morning, if I was speeding, I'd be 500 miles from where I was supposed to be, you know. I just never knew where I was going to end up, you know. And the hash, they didn't have any marijuana over there. All they had is hash, and, man, we smoked that 3-4 times a day. Morning, we'd take a break for noon, smoke some more, you know, get off work. By the time I got home after 2 years over there, I could hardly even read. But that booze was mixed right in there too. That booze was mixed right in there. When I came back home from Germany, I had to kind of rehabilitate myself. I was still drinking. I went back to the alcohol. I was still drinking that. That was my deal, my alcohol. The other drugs, I just was testing, you know, kind of experimenting around. But I got home in 1974. In that period of my life, there was a lot of activism going on in the Native American communities, you know. A lot of political things were happening. And I didn't get too mixed up in it, but I grew my hair long, you know, and tried to look radical or something. I don't know, but I wanted to fit in, you know, so what the heck, you know. Get drunk and try to be radical, you know. But my drinking continued there. I immediately got a job. I wanted to be a track and cross country coach is what I wanted to be, and that's what I went to school for. I got some psychology and physical education majors, and so I started teaching in a school back home, the St. Francis Indian School, and we had a pretty good team. We won the state championship 1 year and got second the second year, you know. And the work was good. It was like having fun. It was paying me to have fun, you know. And my drinking continued. It was starting to be a big conflict inside of me, because I was working with these young people, and on one side I was telling them, you know, don't do this, be responsible, blah blah blah. And on the weekends, you know, I'd be somewhere drinking hard and heavy and doing it exactly the opposite of what I was telling these young people to do, you know. And the conflict started inside of me, and it was starting to become, I had a position in society, you know. And at that time, as a young man, I never understood that, you know. It was later. I did that for 2 years, and then I immediately went back to school. You know, I went to University of South Dakota. I got a master's degree, you know. Why not, you know? Something to do, so. And even through that program, I drank very heavily. I'd study, I'd mix myself a drink, and I'd do my studying, and I'd drink, you know. But drinking was getting progressive, you know. I was able to drink more and more. I could drink a whole quart of whiskey, you know, in one night. I could set it down on the table, and I could drink the whole thing up, and I could still drive, and I could still talk to you like I'm talking to you now, you know. Maybe a little bit of slur in there or something, but, you know, you couldn't tell I was really drunk. And I thought, oh man, you know. And I had idols. My uncle used to do that. He used to come and visit my family, and he'd bring his whiskey, and he'd sit down, he'd drink it up, and just like a gentleman, he'd throw the bottle away, and he'd go home. I said, man, that guy's pretty cool, you know. He'd drink all that booze and just never lose his cool, you know. That's the way I wanted to be. And I started to kind of, I didn't know it, but those were my heroes, you know, drinking heroes. And so, by the time I got out of graduate school, I went back and I started working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the tribe and, you know, different positions like that. And my drinking continued and started to get worse, you know. And by the time I turned 32 years old, my life was in a mess. I could hardly function. The drinking was getting it to be days, you know, days. I was supposed to be doing things, and I was still drunk or hanging over, and I couldn't do them. It started to really, really take its toll by then. And in 1981, I had some problems with the law. I woke up one morning, and I was in jail. I was in jail in Vermilion, South Dakota, and I was facing some pretty heavy charges, some charges that would probably put me in prison for a long time. And I sat in that jail, and I was scared, and I didn't know what to do. And I sat in there, and I thought to myself, you know, what is wrong with me? What is wrong with me so I have to be locked up like this in this jail? And I got a piece of paper like this, and I had a pen, and I started to write down things because I was trying to figure out why I was in that jail. I felt like an animal in there. You know, what's wrong with my life? Why do they have to put me in here, you know? And I wrote all these things down. These are the reasons why my life is the way that it is, you know. I got exhausted, and I put it on the shelf, and I went to bed. And the next day I got up, it was a big, big cell. I was in there by myself. And I got that paper down the next morning, and I started to look at it, you know. And as I was reading it, you know, I could feel a tightness in my throat, and I started to cry, you know. I started to cry because for the first time in my life, I realized that the things that I wrote on that paper, they were not true. They were not true. These were things that I told people about me. These were things that, you know, I believe. It was kind of like taking the cover off of something. And I cried because it was the reality that I was afraid of all my life. It was the first time that there was a. I've heard some people say a moment of clarity. a moment of clarity when all this stuff goes away and you see things exactly as they are. That's what was happening to me. I couldn't pretend anymore. And that started a process for me. I sat in that jail for months waiting to go to trial and all this, and my family came up with some money and got some lawyers, and we went about it, and in the end the charges were dropped and I was able to get out of there. Very political things happened, you know, in my favor, and much to the dismay of many people. But that's what happened to me. And from that, the judge from that sent me to treatment. I went to treatment at the VA hospital in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And it was the first time that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank the people that go into the institution, you know, that go into the institution, because I'm sitting in that VA hospital and I'm, you know, I don't know what's happening with my life. It's upside down, you know, and I'm there for some reason. And they taught me a lot of things. I was kind of like an intellectual guy. I studied things, you know. And so when they presented that information to me, I absorbed it. They showed me a picture of all the medical aspects of alcoholism, you know, what happens to your body, your nerves, your brain, your liver, your stomach, you know, all these problems after you pour alcohol in your body year after year after year. It starts to break down. And I was able to see some of those things in myself. But I never stopped and saw it the way that I saw it at that time. They showed me a mental and emotional picture of how, after a long period of time of drinking, how you don't grow in certain ways, that you're immature, that certain parts of you don't develop because you don't interact normally with people in the society. And bingo, I was amazed because I could see myself in that. I could do a couple of things really well. I could get mad as hell and I could pout, and that's about it, you know. But man, the lights came on. The light came on in this corner and the light came on in that corner, you know. And then they started talking about the intellectual part of it, you know, how you're affected that way. And man, I looked at that and I could see, you know, I could see that piece of paper, you know. I had it in black and white, you know. The problem, the reason why I was in that jail, and it says it in the big book, you know, I could not tell the true from the false. That was wrong with my life. After a period of time, I could not tell the truth from the false. And in that piece of paper, I had it in black and white, you know. There was nobody in that jail to lie to. I was there by myself. And I'm grateful to God that that experience happened to me. And I pray that it happens for other people somewhere along this road of alcoholism, you know, because that's what started getting me help. And that treatment center, the last thing they talked about was the spiritual part of it, you know. And that was the darkest corner. That was the darkest corner for me. At that age, I never understood it. I grew up, my grandmother woke us up Sunday morning, every morning, took us to that Catholic church, you know. And we even served Mass in there, you know. I was an altar boy, I served Mass in there. I never understood all that Latin, you know, and that stuff, but I knew how to say it, you know. But I was in there, you know. And later in life, when I came into the program and I started working on some of these steps, I had to revisit that, you know, revisit that area and, you know, either wipe the slate clean or whatever. And that's what I did. But after I started to put some of that stuff together, the AA people would come in, you know, and they would talk. And I started to see some things, you know. I started to listen to the way they talked, and they talked directly, and there seemed to be a lot of truth in what they talk about, you know. And they used to take us out to AA meetings too. And I was going through a lot of stuff then, you know, some denial. The way I grew up, you know, I had to deal with a lot of stuff. I dealt with a lot of prejudice all my life, you know. And I came to an AA meeting like this, and I sat down there, and the lady came out. The white lady, she had her hair all fixed up and dressed up pretty nice, you know, and she started talking. She started talking about her story, and I said, boy, this is really sounding bad, you know. And she finally got to the point. She said, and that's when I got my DWI. And in my mind, I thought, oh, Christ, is that all she's talking about? You know? I said, boy, this lady don't know nothing about drinking, you know? And, that's the way I was thinking. Because I'd been through all this stuff in my life. And so it was kind of hard for me to identify right away, you know? And I still had this Indian white man complex, you know? And I'd used that all my life for a lot of different reasons, you know, and I still had a lot of that at that time when I came in. And that was one of the other things that I had to deal with, you know. I'm going to have to push my story along here a little bit faster. Anyway, I started going to meetings there. I got out of there. I lived in a halfway house. I got a home group called McKinnon Park. Man, they had meetings 5 o'clock, another one at 8. And on weekends, they had meetings all weekend, sometimes late meetings, 10:30. I started going to meetings there. Somebody said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Well, I started that. And pretty soon, I was going twice a day, you know. And I was going like that for years. I went like that for years, you know. In the beginning, I avoided all those big book meetings. I avoided all those traditions meetings. I went to the discussion meetings because I wanted to talk, you know. Yeah, it's amazing. And after a period of time, I ran out of things to say because I wasn't working the steps. Everybody else was working the steps and talking about that spiritual journey, and I was still talking something. I don't know what I was saying, but. And so I got a little pressure to get with the program, you know, and I started. I got me a sponsor, and I started working through the program and started to put my own recovery together. And then I started going to those big book meetings, and I started to go to those tradition meetings, and that's when my recovery really kind of kicked in. I started to learn more about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to stay sober longer. The first time I relapsed, I went to that halfway house. I stayed in there for 6 months, and I wanted to go home for a visit, so I got in my car, and I started going home. 200 miles I had to drive. The closer I got to home, the more I felt like drinking. Finally, 40 miles from home, I pulled into O'Malley's liquor store. I bought a case of beer and a quart of whiskey, and I locked it in the trunk, and I thought, well, just in case, you know. When I got home, my brother was there, and we started talking. In less than an hour, we had that trunk open, and we were drinking. That was my first relapse in this program. And I sobered up through a series of relapses. It took me about 2 years to get the sobriety that I have now, you know. My last drink was January 13th, 1986. I'm going to jump over a lot of stuff here. And when I was 4 years sober, I went to Las Vegas, Nevada. I attended the first National International Native American AA Convention. A guy by the name of Earl L. had this tremendous idea that we should get this program started for the Native American community. I went there, and I've been plugged into that committee for 14 years now. I got on that committee, and they can't get rid of me, you know. We carry the message to all parts of the country. We've been to Rapid City, Seattle, Reno, Mesquite, Las Vegas, Minneapolis. This year we're going to be in St. Paul, Minnesota at the downtown Radisson starting October 27th. And as a result of getting into that service work, I've had the opportunity to meet people from all over the country, you know. And we have six speakers at our convention every year, and that is building. That resource for our Native American community is building. People are sharing, coming to the convention, telling their stories, and helping other people. We have about 10 states now that have Native American Alcoholics Anonymous conventions in this country. Fifteen years ago, I read some articles in some of the AA literature. A guy by the name of Michael Alexander. I was trying to meet him this weekend. If you're sitting out there, I'd like to meet you before I go home. And some of the comments that he made about Alcoholics Anonymous and reaching out to minorities. 15 years ago. Now, across this country where I travel around, I can go to a Native American reservation and find an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It wasn't like that 15 years ago. It was not. And ladies and gentlemen, and all of the Native American people that have been involved in service work, that have helped carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to our people, you know, what I'm saying it for you too, you know, because you guys are the ones that are making things happen out there. You're sharing, you're doing things. And listen to this one. Right down here, the Native American Indian in North America is amongst the countries in the parade of flags today. It wasn't like that 15 years ago. And we didn't do it by ourselves. It was you people. It was you people that helped carry the message to our communities, help come to our conventions and share and do service work for us and help us get going. You know, I heard a lot of stories about Indians being the only Indian in an AA meeting somewhere, you know. Countless stories. At that meeting in Las Vegas, I've heard people talk about the things that I wanted to share in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had the right forum, you know. People talked about the relocation programs of this federal government. They talked about the trust factors. You know, the federal government and the Indian people in this country had a very poor relationship. That is getting better. But not long ago, my grandparents were probably killing some of your grandparents, and your grandparents killing mine, you know. And that's the way it was. And that's not too long ago, you know. And there's a lot of trust factors there for a lot of Native Americans yet, you know. And the spirituality issues, you know, where some of us grew up in boarding schools and now we're looking at our own tribal belief systems and trying to balance those things in our lives, you know. And a whole host of things. Some of us are mixed bloods, you know. Some of us come from two different cultures and we're all Native Americans. There's a whole all kinds of issues that we have to deal with in sobriety, the identity, you know. At that first convention in Las Vegas, all these things were just pouring out. It was such a beautiful, beautiful experience to see so many sober Indians in one spot. And over the years, you know, we're having our 15th national international convention, and we're I don't know if we can say, I don't know if we can say this, but we have a web site that puts all the information about the convention, and it's www.nai-aa.com, and we run the program Alcoholics Anonymous. There's factions in this country that are trying to do some things. They want to create the wheel all over again. Some of us love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous the way that it is, and we're going to carry that message to the rest of the Indian world. I read the book AA Comes of Age. I couldn't put it down. I read it from the first page to the last. And what I see happening today is some of our new groups, some of our new areas are growing. AA is growing in our Indian communities, but it's also going through this growth period. Some of it is being, you know, enmeshed with some things. Some of it is being, you know, twist it a little bit this way. It's a growing process. Some of us know those things are happening. But I think with time, and with the help of AA members, that road will become clear. You know, for those that don't understand AA yet, that's our responsibility to carry that message to them so they can get it right, you know. AA has its traditions too. You know, our Indian people have our traditions. And it's a fine line to separate those things and keep those things on course. When they get twisted and bent a little bit, it confuses the new people that come in, you know. And shame on those people that try to take advantage of that, you know. AA newcomers are vulnerable. The people out here, you know, there's a phenomena going on in this world. The Native American culture has some people interested in it. But that interest, we should come across to you and present to you our knowledge, our wisdom, our information in such a way, that in a respectful way, on both sides of the street, you know. And it's irresponsible for me to charge you some money for that, you know, or charge you some money for AA, you know. I think in due time some of those things will get straightened out, you know. But that's what's happening in our Indian communities. AA is new and it's growing, and there's common problems that even AA had in its beginning days, you know. Those Washingtonians, they really went that way somewhere or whatever, you know. But yeah, we're learning too. We're learning about AA. And so my sobriety has been like that. I've been involved in service work heavily. I've been all over the place, met a lot of people. And it's just been a fantastic trip for me. You know, I don't want to drink. I barely got out of there, you know. And I don't want to drink. Today I have three children. The oldest daughter is 25. My twin daughters are 22, you know. And one of them was supposed to come with me, but she had a DWI and she couldn't, you know. So it's in the family. And a few years ago, I met a young lady, and I got a 4-year-old boy and a 3-year-old boy, you know. I'm an old father, and I love it. Oh, it's beautiful. There's a lot more, but I have said enough. I've come, and I'm grateful. Whoever had the idea for me to come up here, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to remember this all my life, and I hope that my being here is an example for not only my family, but for others, you know. That I met one guy out there, and he said, are you a speaker? I said, yeah. He just kind of looked me over. How do you become a speaker anyway? He said, stay sober, you know. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ken. Our next speaker is from New York. Please help me welcome Jessamy M.
Hello, my name is Jessamy, and I'm an alcoholic. I am so grateful to be sober this morning, and I am so grateful to be at an AA meeting. It's truly an honor and a privilege to speak at any AA meeting. And, you know, I'm here because I'm powerless over alcohol. That's really just the bottom line. I can't drink safely. What happened to me is I'm just a garden variety alcoholic. I really can look back on my life and my childhood, and when our literature talks about the spiritual malady, I can really see evidence of that in my life long before I picked up a drink. And the way that manifested for me was I was extremely self-centered. I was extremely consumed with what you thought of me, of how I looked to you, of my place in the world, of what I could get. and what I could get from you specifically. And just really kind of that twisted character was really present. So needless to say, I was really an alcoholic waiting to happen. I was really primed for a drink. I was, just so consumed with self. And when my path crossed with booze, oh, man, that was a relief. I'll tell you, if you felt the way that I felt when you drank, you would be so stupid not to continue drinking. It was really what I was looking for. And I'll tell you, that first drink, I drank as quickly as possible, as much as possible. And I threw up on myself, I humiliated myself, and I hurt people that loved me. And you know what? That's the story. Didn't get any better. It didn't get any more glamorous, though I tried. I think the thing is that there was that first kind of magic with that first drink, and I spent the rest of my drinking career chasing that. And I never found it again, that relief. But what ended up happening was I began to experience the progression of alcoholism, which I did not know was happening. I kind of feel that from that first drink, it was like blinders went on, and suddenly the most important thing was my next drink. And when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking, and I was thinking about where I was going to get that drink, where I was going to get the money, who was I going to have to con, who was I going to have to lie to, and, was I going to get that look? That look that we get from people that love and care about us. I'm truly blessed that a member of my family got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was quite young. And what happened was that ruined my drinking before I even started. So for those of you that have children, just remember that. I could never drink without knowing that there was another way of life, that there was a way out. And so what happened was I kind of fumbled along. And let me just tell you about the way I drank. I never had any illusion of kind of social drinking. I think for a while I tried to drink like some cheap wine to have some illusion of like maybe I was fancy. But from the beginning, it was pretty much like cheap, generic vodka in the big plastic gallon. And so what we would do is we would get those plastic convenience store cups that are about that big. And, you'd kind of go to make yourself a mixed drink. You'd get some powdered, fruit juice. You'd pour it in. You'd add the appropriate amount of water and then the appropriate amount of vodka. So then we got this bright idea, why are we diluting the drink with some water when we could just mix the vodka into the Kool-Aid and then, thereby eliminating something? Then there was the brilliant idea of why are we even adding the Kool-Aid when you can just save the 59 cents for a pack, some cigarettes or something. So that was kind of, it was utilitarian, it was practical, it was quantity as opposed to quality, and I was a young woman, and I was drinking, and I got in quite a few jams. And if you were there, you know what it was like, and if you weren't, you don't need to know. This is what happened to me. I really, I feel like the most exciting part in somebody's story for me is that moment that we get to, that moment where our literature talks about the jumping off place. And, I'm so blessed that I had parents, and in particular, I had a mother that loved me when I couldn't love myself, and a mother that took an interest in my life when I couldn't. And, she filled out college applications for me because I could have cared less what happened to me. I mean, my goal was to live in I wanted an apartment and a fridge for some beer. That was like I had arrived. And I was blessed enough to, have people that loved me. And thank God for those people. At the time, it was such a hindrance to my drinking. If you only, got off my back and left me alone, I could drink the way I wanted to. So what happened is, you know, I say this, I believe in the power of prayer today, and I believe that those prayers are what got me here. Because I'm certainly here of no virtue of my own. I know there are a lot of people that have my same story that are not here today. And what that makes this for me is that much more of a tremendous, tremendous gift. So anyway, I, you know, found myself at this university, being able to have a drink whenever I wanted, drinking as often as I wanted. And, you know, what started to happen is I would go through people as if they were disposable because, like I said, I was so self-centered. So they would be gone after whatever I needed or wanted. And I found myself one morning after a typical drunk. It was not anything, you know, spectacular. It wasn't the worst drunk. It wasn't the best drunk. I just came to, and it was, you know, it was over. That's really what happened. And I think that night before, I remember I'd been wandering around, and I'd had this sensation of drinking as much as I possibly could, and being unable to get drunk, of being physically drunk and mentally sober. And that place was horrendous. Awful, with no relief. So I came to, and I was given that moment of clarity that we talk about, that moment where truth and honesty collided, and I saw myself for who and what I really was, which was a drunk. And I am so, so grateful for that moment. You know, I look back on that moment, and I didn't know it at the time, but that was the most important thing that it will ever happen to me. There is nothing, there is no job, there is no relationship, there is no person, place, or thing that is ever going to top that sweet, sweet moment where the window opened for just a moment and I had the willingness to walk through. So, you know, in typical, like, typical high drama, you know, in a solemn act of renewal and symbolism, I shaved my head. Let me also note, this is like true alcoholic reasoning. It was January 30th, 1994. So end of January, there I am, arriving at the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so I had my shaved head. I wore this watch cap because brilliant me had shaved my head in the middle of winter in Massachusetts. So I show up with this watch cap. I had this military overcoat that I wore every day that fit a six-pack and a pint quite nicely. I wore a men's oversized turtleneck, you know, pulled up to here, black leggings, black combat boots. So, you know, I was about as cuddly as a dry stick. But you know what? I go shuffling in, show up, AA, and you welcomed me with open arms. There were people, talk about unconditional love. You know, people just did things like remembered my name. People remembered facts about myself. They remembered, you know, things that I said. They remembered what I was studying in school. They took an interest in my life, and, you know, it had been a long time since anyone had asked me questions about me and wanted and genuinely listened when I went to answer. And what you people did is you assured me beyond a shadow of a doubt that if I made my sobriety the most important thing in my life, everything else would fall into place. And I have to tell you, that has been my experience. Yeah. You know, because I had a lot of problems when I got to AA. You know, I spent my whole life feeling like I'm just so different if only I fit in. And then the first thing I wanted to be when I got to AA was different. I was not like you, and I was going to tell you why. But I had some very kind and loving people that just would listen to me. And I had a sponsor. God bless my first sponsor. I was this, like, twerpy little kid. And she would pick me up every Tuesday night, and I was terrified of her because she was like a lady. Like, she was clean, and like, she had her hair done, and like, wore makeup, and had, you know, socks that matched, and like, a husband, and a dog, and furniture, and all this stuff that was kind of beyond me. You know, I was a scrappy drunk, and I felt dirty on the inside and dirty on the outside. And this woman would just pick me up, and she would do things to me. Like, I would call her up, and I would be like, I'm really afraid I'm going to drink today. And she'd be like, did you pray this morning? And I'd say, yes. And she'd say, well, then don't worry about it. Click. So, and she'd do things like, I'd call her up, and I'd be like going on and on. I'd complain about two things, my boyfriend and my roommate. And she'd say things to me like, I want you to go to a meeting tonight and go up to somebody and ask them how they're doing. And you're not allowed to talk about yourself. How much did that suck? So anyway, but you know what? I had that gift of desperation. It was like I was done. You know, alcohol, I was driven here under the lash of my alcoholism. There was no fight. You know, it was like, really, I knew, for me, to drink is to die. There is no doubt in my mind. And you know what, I'll tell you, we don't die glamorous deaths. I mean, I always kind of fancied it would be this, you know, very like rock star kind of thing. But, you know, at the end of my drinking, I was living in this, I was house sitting in the middle of winter, you know, and I was drinking, and I would find myself kind of wandering around in these snowbanks about this high. And, you know, that's the kind of drunk I am. I would, you know, pass out in one of those and freeze to death or something like that. Like, it would not be, I wouldn't go out in a burst of flames. So anyway, this woman brought me on a journey through the 12 steps, and what has happened is Alcoholics Anonymous has transformed my life. I am standing here an absolute product of you people and the spiritual principles that we live by. I can't articulate what I've been given. It is the magnitude of what we do here is just enormous. We've been given the power to save each other's lives, and I take that very, very seriously. This is such a gift. You know, ever since I took my third step, my sponsor said to me, she said, you know, you're going to have a vein of gratitude that's going to run through you, and no matter what, you're going to be grateful that you're sober. And that has been my experience. I wake up, I can't believe I didn't drink today. I mean, it's just, I'm in awe. I'm in awe of the love of a higher power that picked me up by the scruff of the neck and dropped me on the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really, you know, it blows my mind. So what I try to do today is, you know, our 12th step in the 12 and 12, the first line says the joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and action is its key word. And that, for me, is something I try to live by. I have been given so much that I really feel that, you know, the debt is so huge to Alcoholics Anonymous. How will I ever repay it? And so what I do is I do what I did, what I heard in my first AA meeting. They said, plan your day around an AA meeting, get a home group, get a sponsor, stick your hand out to somebody else. And that served me very, very well. My home group is the New Garden Group in Manhattan on West 31st. And I want to say, if you're ever in the neighborhood, you're all welcome. We'd love to have you. You know, I did have the opportunity to do all sorts of service on the group level and beyond. And I was very touched by the institution, the warden, and I had the opportunity to do an adolescent detox because I thought it was very fitting that I should do that when I came in. And what happened was every Friday night, I would be like, oh, I have to go to that smelly detox with those twerpy kids. And like, you know, I wanted to go to the meeting where all the cool kids were and I could look at the boys and all that business. And I would go in there and I would leave and it would be as if the weight of the world was off my shoulders. You know, I just have to say that for me, the message of AA is a message of hope. And it's a message that we don't have to die drunk and we don't have to die alone and that there's a way up and out of alcoholism. I just feel that, like, each and every one of you is so, so precious and you are all a part of my sobriety. And I want to thank you so much for having me.
Our third and final presenter is from Aberdeen, North Carolina. He is a friend of mine, Tom I.
Are you out there? I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, member of the primary purpose group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and delighted to, well, to be with you. I can't see you, but I'm delighted to be with you. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here and to get a chance to share just a little bit with you. Don't have much time, so I'm going to have to talk fast. It won't sound like I am, but I'm going to be talking real fast. But being from North Carolina, that takes a long time. I really want to say a big thanks to Canada and for hosting us in the country. And to Toronto, the city in which we sit, and the first city that has ever had the International twice. Thank you, Toronto. I think there's a message in that. This has been a great conference, really well done, well put together, and I'm just delighted to have a little piece of it. I really thought, you know how we get sometimes, I thought, well, I'll probably be the token corrections guy with a little history of that sort of thing on the program. I swear to God, by the end of the conference, I felt like it was a status symbol. And we got a lot of that stuff going on. And I was just delighted that that book went to Clint Duffy. I had the great pleasure of meeting him and doing some work with him. So that was a very fitting thing, and I really appreciated seeing that. I also want to say hello to the new territory. I didn't even know it existed. Nanuya. I think they were trying to name it New York, but they were drunk, and it came out in Nanuya. Anyway, welcome. 850,000 square miles of place for alcoholics to roam. A lot of deja vu involved in this for me this morning. 40 years ago this date, I was sitting in this city, in Maple Leaf Gardens, at my first International, and I heard our founder, Bill, introduce the Declaration of Responsibility. What a great day that was. And what a great experience to be with Bill, because during the course of that conference, I really understood Bill's vision and came to claim it as my own. It became my vision. And I left this conference with that vision beating in my heart, and the confidence in AA had never been stronger. At that time, I was a guy 8 years sober, the clouds were just starting to open up a little bit so that there was some sunshine. And when I came here and moved into this world and listened to our founder share that vision, I left here a different man than I came in. And so it is really great to be back in this city and to be able to reminisce a little bit about that. The other thing I was just mentioning about that international, I'm going to get this out of the way, and then we'll drink whiskey and throw up and all that. The other thing I want to mention about that, a convention can be one of the loneliest places in the world. I'll guarantee you there are people in this room who have spent this weekend as if the convention was behind a glass wall, who are still into enough isolation that it's almost like an unbelievable fairy tale scene. And it takes a while to grow out of that. When I came to let me offer you this for whatever hope it might involve. When I came to that conference, I knew a few people. They all might have been 18 or 20 out of the bunch that were here. And it was not a lonely place, because I just kind of like to mix it up anyway. But what a contrast, eh? Today, when I come to this international convention, I think I know half the people here. And that's the miracle of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. Never have to be alone again. And that is literally true. Literally true. Now, I want to tell you a little. Oh, by the way, I do have to tell you one other thing about Canada. I'm not only grateful for internationals, I'm deeply grateful to this country. Because I've been in most of the provinces except the Nunavut. I haven't been there yet because I didn't know about it. But I've been all over this dominion and have had marvelous experiences all over this place. And great memories of every place I've ever been. My sponsor is a very shy, retiring, diminutive man who's of a Canadian and happens to be from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and his name is Cease. I have a wife who's sitting out in the darkness somewhere in this room who's from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and now we've Americanized her. We've almost taught her to speak proper English down south, but she's learning slowly. That's been great stuff. I've got a lot of gratitude for Canada. I try to show my gratitude by sleeping with a Canadian woman every night that I possibly can. Now that I'm sober, it's my wife from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. So, a lot to be grateful for. Now, let me tell you about me. I'm just one of those sort of. Well, I don't know if I was typical for the day, but I think I was a prototype of the type to come. I was one of those early basket case type of people who just crashed and burned at a very early age. That's not unusual this day and time. Our world is riddled with people like me. But back then, it was a little bit out of the ordinary. And so I was just a guy who crashed and burned very quickly. I started serious drinking in my teens, and I'm going to go through it quickly because, I'm just that. And it went through in my teens. I fell in love with booze. I developed alcoholism by the time I was 18 years old, and I had a very chaotic life. Mine was characterized by just an overwhelming record of failure. I screwed up everything I ever touched. I lost every job I ever had, never held one for as much as a year. I was a real bad case. I was a guy thrown out of the military with an undesirable discharge when I was 20 years old. Went to jails a lot. Went to psychiatric, what do you call them, psych wards a lot. Went to any place that they captured drunks. If they captured drunks, I've been there. Never did go to treatment. It hadn't been invented. We had very effective detox, but it was called jail. I always like to tell people who say they can't get sober, don't bet on it, buddy. Smack a cop. You'll get sober real quick. I don't advocate for the return of those good old days, but that was it. And so in the process of that bedlam called Tom I's life, I was going right straight down the tube. And I wound up as a young man living up in, I'll let them remain anonymous. Well, no, they deserve to be known. I wound up in a place called Flint, Michigan. Only place I'll tell you, go flat. I ain't going with you. Oh, did I say about Flint? It deserved a guy like me. And that's where I really crashed and burned, just came unglued. I wound up unemployed, darn near unemployable. And essentially just kind of, I used to say live by my wits. That's not exactly true. I live by my lack of character. I was what they call amoral. I've never turned down anything on the grounds of morals or ethics or principles. I didn't even know what those were. But that's where I wound up. And as a young man, I reached a point where suicide was sort of a tempting thought. In my early 20s, when most folks are worried about what to do with their life, I'm worried about how to end mine. Yeah, I wound up selling my blood in that city, $5 a throw, just to survive and deal. I wound up surviving by taking from other people, rolling other drunks. I don't really put that in the amends column because it was sort of the food chain where I lived. You were either the rollee or the roller. Somebody gonna get rolled, you know. And so I just happened to be on both sides of that deal a lot. And so wound up. And then, you know, and so my life was just crashing ahead. This wasn't something, if there was any characteristic that was constant in it, it was that once in a while I would straighten up and I would do impossibly well. But I had an unusual propensity to take a drink at exactly the wrong time and screw up the best of plans. And so in the meantime, I'm just crashing down. And then I finally found myself, when I say found myself, I knew where I was. I was aware of time and place, but I found myself sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary. That's one reason I said correction seems to be in vogue this weekend. I found myself sitting in one. Going to institutions was not a novelty for me, but going to a maximum custody penitentiary was. And that's where when I say found myself, that's where I was when the fog lifted. What our first speaker was talking about was that clarity. Where I, for the first time that I had stopped long enough and taken a serious enough look at my life to see who I was, what was happening, and where I was going. And what I saw looked awful no matter which way you looked at it. The past was too bad to look at. The future was a dark cave. The present was unbearable. And so that's who I was when I came to. To add to that, I was in there for a crime that's all too familiar to alcoholics. I was there for a crime that I committed in a blackout that I had no recollection of then or now or ever. But a crime that too horrible for punishment. There is no adequate punishment for the crime I committed. I could be nice and say that I had an unavoidable accident. Fact of business is, I don't know. I couldn't even be a witness at my own trial. I had to listen as if I were on the jury. And I would have been for conviction at the end. There was no question that I did. What I had done was taken the lives of two young people with their lives in front of them, whose only mistake was trying to cross the street in which I was driving. So that was the reality that I came to grips with when I started to be aware of who I was and what had happened and what I was about. And that was absolutely the end of the line. I had snapped into isolation as severe as I'd ever known, and I'm confident, without any question, that I would have stayed in that isolation, that absolute tomb of guilt for the time that I remained in that place and survived. I never thought I'd ever come out of there alive and didn't care. Didn't care. All I wanted to do was disappear. It put me in a cell, sat in there, tried to do anything I could do to keep from thinking. And thank God for people who recognize alcoholism and take actions to try to motivate doing something about it. Thank God for that. You know, thank God for a program we have in Alcoholics Anonymous that's called cooperation with the professional community. You know, sometimes we think that means mail them a pamphlet. That's not what it means. It means to engage and try to find out ways that we can cooperatively interact. I'm extremely grateful for that because whether we called it that or not, that's the thing that decided my fate. Because I'll tell you what happened. One day a guy called me out for an interview. Didn't have any trouble diagnosing me. Nobody ever had. I never had one diagnosed in my life. And my God, you drink a lot. Or you're a drunk. Or you're an alcoholic. He was the same. And the only difference was he added something I never heard. He said, we have an AA group here. And I think you ought to go. There was no command. There was no mandate. There was no consequences if I didn't. Just a flat, friendly statement. You ought to go, man. They fix it. And so I walked into my first meeting, Groundhog Day of 57, and by the amazing grace of God, I've never had a drink since. Amazing to me. Excellent. And I'd love to thank you very much for that. I'd love to regale you with a long story about that, because that journey back from desperation, that journey back from defeat, that climbing out of the ashes, God, what a thrilling story that is. And what an encouraging, hopeful story that is, because I'm exactly the guy I was just telling you about. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was absolutely in withdrawal. We had a huge group there, 300 folks, first meeting. Nobody spoke to him except the correctional officer. Had him on the door, read my name, Iverson, I sat down, listened to my first meeting. And what I had walked into, thank God again, was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not talking about a nice little gathering and a fine fellowship. I'm talking about an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. As good as I've ever seen. I've been to them all over the world. But it's as good as any group I've ever seen. Thank God. I think that was maybe, not in spite of the condition, maybe because of it. Because of the setting and the environment, it took a strong group to do it. And I'm so grateful. What I mean by strong group, it was a group that had a purpose. It was clearly spelled out. We knew what we were trying to do. Tradition 5 was alive and well in that group and fully practiced. That's where I got introduced to a service ethic. That's where I got introduced to steps. That's where I got introduced to the real work of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's also the first place I ever experienced freedom in my entire life. In a maximum custody penitentiary, locked up like a wild animal, and became free. If you don't think this is a powerful program, take a look. That's the first place I ever felt decency and honesty and integrity and worth. And they were products of this program. Nothing that has ever come my way in Alcoholics Anonymous has never been more richly effective than what I received in that penitentiary. And so I became a real functioning member of AA. And when they got, I guess, watching what I was doing, they figured I could do that pretty well on the outside. And they decided to release me when I'd only been there 3.5 years on a 15-year sentence and the minimum eligibility. And so they released me. And when I left that place, I had the dreams, as any person has when they're coming back. Whether it's in a ritzy treatment center or a penitentiary, everybody comes out with the fears and uncertainty and anxiety and apprehension. And I was no different. I had all the fears, but also had the sure knowledge that I had a program that was a vehicle to a new life. And I knew that. I knew without any question whatsoever. And so I had some dreams, little dreams, real little dreams, that sound ridiculous to somebody who grew up in a fairly normal circumstance. Yeah, I wanted to be a citizen. I never had been. I'd never voted. I'd never paid taxes. I'd never had any concern. I didn't raise property values. I brought them down just by moving in. So I wanted to be a citizen. I wanted to take part in this thing called life. I wanted to work for a living. Do an honest day's work for a decent day's pay. I wanted to have a friend again. I'd never had a real friend who wasn't a bad drunk in my life. I wanted to have a friend. Didn't know if I ever would or not. Wanted to be trusted. Didn't know if I ever would or not. Little dreams, eh? Little, eh? You tell them in Canada. It takes me about a day to catch that and 2 months to get rid of it. But those were what I was looking for. I just wanted to find a place in the world. And so I hit the ground. I got immediately active in AA, and that is truly the understatement of the millennium. I was running like a wild goat. Man, I'm telling you, I had the divine privilege of helping start Alcoholics Anonymous in the city. And that is a marvelous, marvelous privilege. I highly recommend it. Well, I imagine up in the nook, they're going to get a chance to do some of that. And a great, great feeling. And so I got off and running. And I want to tell you, I should have looked what time I started. But Gary will tell me. And as big and bad looking as he is, I'll listen. I will tell you, and just preface it just a little bit. I want to tell you about some things that happened in my life your number one dreams come true, because every dream I ever had came true, and some I wouldn't have dared dream have come true. And that is so, so absolutely true. And that's, to me, it's predicated on two things that are basic principles of AA in my mind. One is that miracles happen. Now, I'm a pretty practical-minded, pragmatic sort of guy. I'm not some mystical magic show guy. I'm a deeply spiritual man. I believe what the book says, the spiritual life is not a theory. You've got to live it. It's either everything or it's nothing. So I'm a spiritual man in everything that I do. And so I think the spiritual life is not a theory. And as a result of that, miracles happen. And I don't put a lot of sort of mystique on a miracle. To me, a miracle is what occurs when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction. And that's when miracles happen. And God knows how many I've had in my life. And I hope you have too. Miracles happen. The other thing that's not a theory to me, it's something I absolutely know, is that when we turn a broken and wasted life over to this simple but powerful program, and God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what the walls come down. I meet people all the time who are imprisoned by their past, who are imprisoned by their fear, and I'm here to tell you that the walls will come down. If I give my life to this simple program and take the actions, my God, stuff will happen. And what happened with me? When I hit the street, I got immediately active, went to meeting the first night, every night for a long, long time, and guys got me involved in prison. I didn't know I was going to be able to get back in. I thought I had a chance of getting back in, but I didn't think I was going to get to go visit an AA group in one. Take it with us out. Some guys said, come go with us. And I said, where? They said, jail. I said, hey, they're not going to let me in. I'm just out of a maximum custody joint. Come on. It's no problem. We walked in. 2 months later, I was named outside sponsor of that prison. I'm just out of maximum custody. I'm still on parole. And for God's sakes, they make me a trusted servant, eh, to look after a program in a prison. That's an unbelievable thing to me. And I could have been more honored if it elected me governor. Good God. A train of total affirmation. About the same time, a pro guy came to me one day and said, Tom, you really acted as anything in conservative. I thought he was going to try to tell me to slow down. I knew I wouldn't. Because parole was not my lifeline. AA was my lifeline. So I knew I wouldn't slow down. And he said, real active. I said, yeah. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? Well, for obvious reason, when I'd left the state of Michigan, letters that big on my paper, this man never operated a motor vehicle, this man never drank alcoholic beer. I took both of those as facts of life. And I never believed I'd ever operate a vehicle. I wasn't sure I ever wanted to, because I'd done the horrendous damage with one. So I wasn't doing it. So he said, well, let me check it out. A little lady called me, asked me to meet him uptown in my city where I live. And walked in, met him, he and my pro guy and another guy were standing there talking. I didn't interrupt him. I just sort of let him talk. And they finally turned around to me. The guy introduced himself that I didn't know. He was the driver's license man. Chatted just a minute, not about driving, just about coon dogs and possums and stuff like that. And when we got through chatting, he handed me a driver's license. Didn't even ask me if I could drive. No test, road, written, verbal, nothing. Didn't even pay for it. You know, it can't be legal. But I've been driving ever since. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. If I had been trying to con and manipulate that into happening, I would be walking today, and I believe that. So miracles happen. I was elected DCM 5 months after I was out. I'd gone to 2 years of Michigan State while I was locked up, but I hadn't learned how to spell DCM, so I wasn't really sure what it was. But I got elected. And same guy who wondered if he'd ever be trusted. Hey, I'm asked to be the trusted servant for 15 cities. Amazing stuff. 2 years after that, I got a call one day from state capitol in my state. A guy on the phone I'd met once, a few minutes, he worked with the prison system. So he asked for Mr. Iverson. I got on the phone, and he said, Mr. Iverson, we're we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prisons, is we wondered if you might consider accepting a position. And first thing I said, you could well imagine, I said, do you know who you're talking to? And he assured me that he did. He said, we've checked you out. And, well, of course they had. And I said to him, just spontaneously, I didn't have to think, I said, my God, man, I'd rather do that than anything in my that I could imagine. But inside, you know what I said. There ain't no way. The day of that phone call, there had never been an ex-con hired into a prison system, and I knew they weren't going to start with me. But if they were going to do it, they had to start with somebody. And I guess I was somebody. And so they did. And so, to remind you again, when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. I don't care what the walls are. And so I went to work scared to death, as you can well imagine. I'm the only guy on the planet with that experience. Who do you talk shop with? There ain't nobody else. You know, so my close confidant was my boss man called God. That was close and very, very essential. The other thing was AA tradition. Tell you what, AA traditions are a fact of life in this guy's life. I practice them in everything that I do. I've used them more in my professional career than anything I ever learned in college. Far more. Far more. Because all it's about is how to get people to work in unity. And that's what they're about. And that's what we do in the world. And so that's what guided me through that uncertain ground of trying to figure out how to be the man. Am I professional? Am I one of the guys? Am I going to be a hoodlum hero with tabloids out and all this? And so what I decided to do was what the principals say, to take my place. If I'm going to take the pay, I'm going to do the job. And I became a professional. And I finished my education in correctional administration. I wasn't ambitious. I just got tired of being the dumbest guy in the room. And so I went back and got my thing just so my resume wouldn't look so weird. You hate to put mental hospitals and jails and this. You got to have a little something else. I didn't need it for my career. My career was taking off like a rocket. When you do good work and you work hard, if you don't watch it, you'll get the Peter principle set in. You'll get elevated to your level of incompetence. And I think that's what happened to me. I got started booted up. And so I went into supervision management. And then one day the head of our system asked me to come by. And they had something he wanted me to do. Normally he wanted me to pinch hit for him somewhere, making a talk or something. So I went by. What is it, boss? He said, Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as administrator, the warden, as it's called in a lot of places. And now I'll tell you, it's one thing. I was in the system. But I was on the good guy side. You know, I loved that mud wrestling with the guys. And when he told me that, I mean, he's talking about being the man. I didn't want to be the man. I said, geez, I didn't want to be the head screw in this place. I just want to sort of duke it out with the guys. And then I said, will you give me some time to think about it? And he said, well, of course. Take 5 minutes. I gratefully took the 5 minutes, went out and prayed hard in the bathroom. That's where I do my best praying. Did some just a little while ago, right back here. Good place, good place. Got sound effects and everything. So I went out and thought about it, and then I went back and I said, okay, I'll do it. That started an increment of my career that I spent about 20 years. And my basic M.O. in the prison system, I kind of like Gene from California said in the workshop yesterday, I had a job description, but my real mission was to shut those suckers down is what I was trying to do. And so I had a great career. I had a wonderful career in the sense that the reason the man wanted me to take that job is that I'm a creative thinker type of guy. If you want somebody to run something, don't get me. Because I guarantee you, I'll make something else out of it by tomorrow. Yeah, I'm a guy who if it's in place, it's old. And so I'm working on plan B. And so that's the way I approach that. And so I had a chance to do some tremendously challenging, rewarding things. I had a career that I wouldn't have traded with Bill Gates. Absolutely super. Finally found out I was old as rat in the barn. I did. Bad thing about it. I'm one of the few people, there's several of us here, but there are not many of us that were here for the 40 years ago for the convention that was here. And so I wound up being the oldest guy in the system. I never wanted to be that, and so I retired. And so I had no, I'll tell you one thing. If you were, and I've seen some people as old as me here, that if you're somebody that's looking at retirement and you're active in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't give it a second thought. Because what a marvelous thing when I retired to see that my decisions about retirement were already taken care of. I had a way of life second to none. And so I was busy the day I retired. I've never been busier in my life than I am right now. And I'll tell you what I want to wrap up around, and I don't have a clue where we are, but I'm just going to go hard as I can. Gary, just tell me when I'm done. I sort of build that around, and really what I'd like to finish up with here today is, you know, in our book, if we don't watch it, we'll turn AA into a something where we think it's all about fixing me, where every meeting it ought to be viewed in terms of what it will do for me. And if you look closely at what our book says, and I can't, if I quote a page number, you better check it out, because I guarantee it'll be wrong. And I won't get the quote exactly right, but it'll be close enough that you can identify it. But if you look at, particularly in that section right after the promises at the end of step 9, it moves into telling us what to do with the new freedom we found. And what we found to be able to look people in the eye and not have to be guilty of being able to be free and to function in this world with some value. And it gives us real clear stuff for that in that little section right after 9, where it says something like this. Of course we're working on ourselves. Of course our problem is fundamental. But our real purpose is to be of maximum service to God and those around us. That's our real purpose. In another place down there, it talks about that you having gotten through that process of amends, it says our task now, the words to that effect, our task now is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. In understanding and effectiveness. And that's what spells out my dance card for what I want to do with my sobriety. And let me just ask you to give this consideration. That I'm doing things, I'm into my 49th year now, and I'm doing things that I did 48 years ago. But I'm doing a whole lot more. I'm doing some of those same things because they're fundamental. The most noble that we ever are as a fellowship is when we do a one-on-one with another alcoholic. There's nothing more noble in AA than that. Fundamental. Fundamental. And it's great work. There's nothing gives you a greater feeling. But is it enough? If I want to be of maximum service, I believe that I've got to get to a point where I look beyond my own shadow. I've got to look beyond what's just right in front of me, of what I can just personally put hands on. If I want to be of maximum effectiveness, I have to widen that sphere of concerns that we have. If I want to be of maximum, now if all I want to do is feel good and focus on me, then I don't need to pay attention to this. But if I really want to be somebody who feels like they're a maximum service and therefore a maximum reward, then I need to take a look and realize that while I may be a wonderful person, there's only so much I can do individually head to head. And that ain't enough for me because I don't think that's maximum effectiveness. And so what we do is I start thinking about my group. My group's not just some place that I selfishly cherish because of what it gives me. It's the place where I do my work. That's where I get my work done. That's where I troll for drunks. That's where I work with people. And my group needs to be a healing place. It needs to be an excellent group where the solution is put out on the table every single meeting. And mine is such a group. And I'm grateful for that. I am truly grateful for that. That's the fundamental building block of AA is that strong home group, not chat shops. Strong home groups, and it's not enough to just be I'm not one who says I belong to the best group in the world. I don't. I belong to an AA group. And it's a good, effective AA group that does a lot of service work, a tremendous amount of service work. And we're well rewarded for that. But it's not enough to just be a good group. What kind of a neighbor am I? What kind of a neighbor are we to the groups around us that may be struggling and don't know the way? You know, how well do we do with that? How well do we do with the... He said for me to quit. Now, he doesn't realize the guy from North Carolina, it takes him a little while to quit. It takes about 2 minutes. And so what this all leads to is that just exponentially grows when you start looking at ways we can be of help. Last thing I'd like to leave with you is this. I'm grateful that the theme of this conference is the one I heard here 40 years ago. And I'd like to ask all of you to really read that declaration of responsibility. That's not a collective pronoun. It says, I am responsible. Having been given the gifts I've been given, I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand to be there, and I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. I don't care whether it's in Nunuk or India, where they've got 30,000 and a whole lot of Indians. We got a lot of work to do. I hope that you'll study that declaration, take it seriously. Thanks a million. Yeah.